Welcome. My name is Dr. David Wiles, Associate Professor of Medicine at the University of California, San Diego. This is an IAS USA learning module on HCV protease inhibitor drug resistance. Today, I will be covering the following key topics as they relate to HCV drug resistance. We're going to go over first resistance concepts and nomenclature, the virology of HCV as it relates to resistance development. I'll then go into an overview of telaprevir and bosepivir resistance, try to offer some practical guidance on the management of resistance with telaprevir and bosepivir, and then finally we'll end with drug resistance and emerging interferon-free therapies. So the next slide covers resistance concepts. First, just some terminology. Resistant variant, sometimes also called resistance mutations, refer to amino acid changes that are responsible for a phenotypic change in the virus or a change in susceptibility to the compound. Variant is preferred in a technical sense because that's alluding to the fact that these are generally pre-existing and selected with drug therapy as opposed to induced changes in the virus by drug therapy. Viral fitness is the cost of the mutation on the virus. Typically, we think about this in the form of worsened replication for the virus harboring a mutation. And this also relates to why, when we remove drug pressure, resistant variants tend to decay in terms of their prevalence within the whole viral quasi-species. Resistance barrier is really a multi-component or numerous component metric describing the ease with which the virus can develop resistance to a particular drug and then subsequently propagate. There are a number of factors to consider. Among key factors that should be considered, the resistance barrier tends to be higher if more than one nucleotide change is required for a phenotypic change. It also tends to be higher if a higher fold change in susceptibility is incurred by the virus with the mutation. And then finally, the pharmacokinetics of an individual antiviral certainly can impact the resistance barrier for that drug when administered to humans. The second part of our concept slide is going to talk about resistance. Genotypic resistance first refers specifically to nucleic acid sequence changes that are identified. The phenotypic resistance, or the actual outcome of resistance, is inferred from a genotypic data. It's not directly tested. And there are numerous ways we can characterize genotypic resistance. Population sequencing is the most common and what is commercially available. That will only detect resistant variants, though, probably at about 20% of the population, give or take. Other options would be clonal or ultra-deep sequencing. These methodologies can detect viral mutations present or viral variants present in a much smaller percentage of the population, although they tend to be labor-intensive or costly at this time, and they're not commercially available or probably clinically relevant at this point in time. Phenotypic resistance testing would involve actually looking at the virus with the mutation and directly assessing the activity of the drug against that resistant variant. At this point in time, however, there are no phenotypic HCV resistance tests available, and this would be in contrast, say, to HIV, where phenotypic resistant tests are available. Then finally, clinical resistance really is not necessarily talking about viral changes or mutations that result in resistance. This is really just the outcome for the patient. So clinical resistance is simply failure to achieve the treatment goal. And when we're talking about HCV, that would be failure to achieve an SVR or sustained virologic response. Moving on to the HCV viral life cycle, as highlighted here in this comparison column table, HCV is set up to rapidly develop viral resistance to drugs. However, it is also set up where that we don't think these resistance variants can persist for long periods of time at enriched levels. The factors that go into rapid resistance development include the very high viral turnover rate for hepatitis C. It's estimated that 10 to the 12 virions are produced per day in an infected individual. This is combined with the fact it has an error-prone RNA polymerase, which acts twice in the replication cycle. Putting those two things together and doing the math, you come up with the fact that probably every resistant variant pre-exists in persons prior to seeing any drug therapy. Finally, unlike HIV and hepatitis B, there are no overlapping reading frames, which put additional constraints on tolerated resistant variants for HIV and hepatitis B. In contrast, the lack of persistence is really related to the fact that HCV is a pure RNA virus. It's a positive sense single-stranded RNA virus. It is not like HIV, a retrovirus, or like HBV, an actual DNA virus. And we don't know of any viral mechanism by which there can be a long-term reservoir of integrated or proviral DNA as we see in HIV. Additionally, The cells that are infected primarily, at least for HCV, are hepatocytes. While they may persist longer than an HIV-infected CD4 T-cell, which the general half-life is about a day, most studies indicate that the half-life of an infected hepatocyte is probably somewhere on the order of several weeks to maybe a month, but not longer. Summing all this up, again, HCV can develop resistance quickly with therapy, and we've already seen this, and we'll go into this in detail, but we don't expect resistant variants to remain enriched for prolonged periods of time after removal of drug. The next section will be overview of resistance to HCV protease inhibitors, meaning the currently approved ones, telaprevir and bosepravir. So as seen in this monotherapy study published in 2007, with monotherapy using telaprevir in persons with chronic HCV infection, what you can see here is everybody starts out with wild-type virus by population sequencing, but by the end of a two-week monotherapy treatment course, almost everybody has resistant variants on sequencing either at the end of the 2 weeks or in the subset of patients who had such a low viral count they couldn't be sequenced right when they stopped. When the virus reemerges a week later, you see resistant variants in that population as well. On the right of the slide, you can see out at long-term follow-up, which looked at about 6 months after therapy had stopped, you do already start to see this phenomenon of wild type taking back over and resistant variant prevalence decaying, again, due to this fitness issue for maintaining viral resistance. To summarize the key resistant variants and how they impact viral fitness, telaprevir and bosepravir resistance profiles, first and foremost, should be assumed to be completely cross-resistant. The most common resistance mutations are completely shared across these two compounds. There is some difference in the resistant variants by genotype subtype, and we'll go into a little more detail on that. Genotype 1A subtype is characterized by the V36M and R155K mutants. You can see these individually, and they cause a low-fold change, or you see the double mutant, the R155K plus V36M, which causes a high-fold change in resistance to telaprevir. In genotype 1B, the variants seen are somewhat different, with the most important variants being the T54AS variant and the A156 variant for low-fold change variants, and then high-fold change variant is the A156T or V. Down at the bottom of the screen, you'll notice the definitions of low and high-fold change variants. These are somewhat arbitrary, with low-fold change variants causing a 3 to 25-fold increase in the IC50 to telaprevir, bosepravir, and a high-fold change being greater than 25. As you can see, the last part, in general, if patients fail therapy and the virus comes back in a relapse, they tend to have low-fold change variants predominant. If you actually see viral breakthrough, meaning the virus reemerges while the patient is still taking telaprevir or bosepravir, high-fold change variants tend to predominate. This is just a graphic showing that trade-off between resistance level and viral fitness. We'll take, for example, the A156V or T variant, which causes a large shift in the IC50 to telaprevir or bosepravir, but also results in a relatively unfit virus with a replication capacity somewhere around 40 to 50%. Contrast this with the V36AM at the other extreme. This causes a low-fold change in telaprevir or bosepravir sensitivity, about a 3 to 7-fold change, but the virus maintains a near wild-type fitness level in terms of replication. It should be pointed out this is purely a replication assay. It does not take into account all methods of viral replication, meaning that this assay does not contain entry or virus release. If we look at treatment failures, this highlights the very high levels of resistance you get if you don't have an active interferon component. For triple therapy with a PI plus pegylated interferon and ribavirin, overall, 50 to 80% of patients who do not achieve an SVR will fail with resistant variants detectable. Now, this was done by population sequencing, and you can see a difference, again, if you have breakthrough with virologic failure, 90 to 95% of patients will have resistant variants detected at breakthrough. If you look at sequencing during a relapse, meaning the patients were undetectable during drug therapy, but then once therapy was removed, they relapsed, there you see less frequent resistant variants, but still 30 to 70% of patients have resistant variants. And again, the main point on the bottom is if you have poor interferon alpha responsiveness, you see increased rates of not only treatment failure, but resistance. And that is highlighted on this next slide, looking at two studies where we look at the number of resistant variants by surrogates for interferon responsiveness. In the SPRINT2 study on the left, I'll draw your attention to the group of patients who had less than a 1 log 10 decline in their HCV RNA during the first 4-week lead-in of pegylated interferon and ribavirin. When bocepavir was subsequently added in these patients who had poor interferon responsiveness, you can see the rates of resistant variant development were 45 to 35% roughly, depending on whether they got response-guided therapy or a full 44 weeks of bocepavir with pegylated interferon and ribavirin. On the right is similar data for telaprevir from the REALIZE study. This was a study looking at retreatment of patients who had previously failed interferon therapy. And in this study, patients could be categorized according to their prior interferon responsiveness by how they responded to their first treatment. If during their original treatment they were a relapser, meaning they were interferon sensitive, you can see we have very high rates of SVR in blue and very low rates of resistance, perhaps only 5% failing with resistant variants in a prior relapser. Going all the way to the right, the group that was a previous null responder, meaning during their prior interferon and ribavirin therapy, they didn't see at least a 2-log decrease in their HCV RNA. When they were subsequently retreated with triple therapy, including telaprevir, again, you see relatively low rates of sustained virologic response, around 30%, and much higher rates of resistance. Makes sense because more patients are failing, with about 50% having resistance on failure during retreatment. Another key concept for treating patients with telaprevir, bocepavir with pegylated interferon and ribavirin is the essential role of ribavirin in enhancing treatment responses and preventing breakthroughs and resistance development. The PROVE 2 study was a phase 2 study of telaprevir, which actually included an arm that did not have ribavirin. Subjects were only given telaprevir and pegylated interferon, and what you can see from the graphic on the left is that with ribavirin removed, breakthrough rates on therapy went up to about 25%. This is in contrast to 5 to 7% with ribavirin in the dosing regimen. And again, all these patients essentially that had breakthrough would be expected to have resistance. On the right, in the SPRINT 1 study, they did not have an arm that looked at no ribavirin, but there was an arm that looked at low-dose ribavirin. In this case, the all-capitalized ribavirin is standard dosing, 800 to 1,400 milligrams, and the lowercase ribavirin is 400 to 1,000 milligrams. And again, the same trend is seen with low, and in this case suggesting underdosing of ribavirin, you see 40% resistance development in contrast to only about 10% with standard dose ribavirin. Now we're going to go to resistance testing in clinical practice. First, we'll talk about commercially available resistance assays. There is an HCV genotypic resistance assay that's clinically available. As mentioned before, this is population sequencing where changes in nucleotides are identified and then a phenotypic change is inferred and reported back to the practitioner. This is offered through LabCorp and Monogram, and the CPT codes are listed there. An important caveat is if you're going to send this test on a patient, their HCV RNA should be above 2,000 IUs per mil to have a good chance of amplifying the virus and being able to actually do the test. And they should have a defined genotype subtype. HCV has enough variability that specialized primers are required depending on the subtype. So this test is available. I think the main issue right now is what is the clinical utility of this test? And at this point in time, it's unclear, and I'll go into a little more detail about why that is. So the next slide outlines what I consider some of the key clinical questions related to resistance. First and foremost, perhaps, is does the presence of resistance predict a treatment outcome? And if it does, under what circumstances? I think we're all used to thinking of HIV, and it's routine now to do baseline HIV resistance testing. So one of the questions for hepatitis C is, should baseline testing be done, and is there any evidence that baseline resistance mutations make a difference? The second key question would be, does resistance testing at the time of failure possess any clinical utility? And kind of implied in that is, can patients who fail with genotypic resistance be retreated in the future with regimens that contain drugs that are possibly cross-resistant? So to answer the first part of those questions, we'll look at the prevalence of baseline variants in some studies. So key resistant variants in most of the phase 3 programs from telaprevir and bocepavir were detected in less than 1% of treatment-naive patients. This is data from telaprevir's phase 3 trials with about 3,500 patients. I picked out just a few of, again, the key mutations we've already talked about. The V36M is present in only about 0.5% of patients at baseline, and the R155K was found in 0.9%, only in 1As, though. And again, this is all population sequencing. And some of the higher fold change but less fit variants, as you might expect, were not found at all. An example here would be the A156 T and V in particular were not found at baseline in any of these patients. Other studies have found higher rates of variant prevalence from 7 to 17%, although this depends a lot on what set of variants you would consider resistant variants. And in this case, the V55A and I were included, and so you see higher prevalence based on population sequencing. But the most important point, and that has the clinical ramifications, is that the presence of baseline resistant variants was not found to impact treatment outcomes for treatment-naive patients. The only subgroup that was there was an indication it may have an impact were patients who had prevalence of key baseline resistant variants, such as the R155K, and who were subsequently found to be interferon non-responsive. The good thing about this combination is that that combination of a baseline prevalent variant at one of the key positions and being interferon unresponsive or poorly responsive occurs in less than probably 1% of the population. From a testing standpoint, I don't think it makes sense to look for baseline variants because it's such a small population that may be impacted. The next concept is decay of the resistance once it's selected for. Again, this is data from telaprevir phase 3 trials, and you can see over on the left at the time everybody fails therapy, in total 74% of patients had resistant variants detected. In this study, they continued to follow the patients off therapy over the next 16 to 18 months here in this graph, and repeat sequencing was done at various time points after failure and removal of drug to look for reversion or re-outgrowth of wild-type virus. And what you see here is a gradual, continuous decline in the prevalence of resistant variants out to 16 months. And actually at 16 months, 96% of patients by population sequencing had only wild-type virus detected. There's similar data with reversion of or loss of resistant variants with boceprevir. So coming back to the key clinical questions with some answers based on that little bit of data, should baseline resistance testing be performed? As I indicated before, I think the answer to this is no, not for treatment-naive patients. If you have a very defined subset of baseline resistance variants with poor interferon alpha responsiveness, that may have an impact, but those patients are rare enough at this time point that it still cannot be recommended to do routine baseline screening, even for patients who are treatment experienced. What about resistance testing upon virologic failure? The main issue right now is there are no viable treatment options for somebody who's already failed a PI with pegylated interferon and ribavirin. If you fail telaprevir and are looking at boceprevir or vice versa, there's just not enough data to indicate that either regimen is significantly more potent than the other. So regardless of resistance, you wouldn't expect a patient to respond to giving the exact same therapy again, taking resistance out of the equation. I think in the future with interferon-free therapies, this may or may not change, and we need the data. So the last part of our key clinical questions, can patients failing with genotypic resistance be retreated successfully in the future with regimens containing a cross-resistant drug? And as I've indicated, we don't really have adequate data to answer this question. As I showed you a couple slides ago, the resistant variants do decay over time, but again, we would need actual retreatment data to answer this question. So what about the impact of resistant variants on future HCV therapies? This table, I just try to lay out kind of schematically how I view the different drug classes in terms of their barrier to resistance, how frequently we see clinical genotypic resistance emerge after treatment, and whether there's any subtype dependence on the resistance development. So for the NS3 protease inhibitors, resistance barrier for current compounds such as telaprevir and boceprevir, I would put at a pretty low resistance barrier, and here I've indicated 2+, indicating a low resistance barrier. However, it should be noted that protease inhibitors in clinical development right now in phase 2 and even some entering phase 3 have been found to have much higher resistance barriers, either due to the actual structure of the molecule or the fact that some are boosted with ritonavir and achieve much better pharmacokinetics. So I do think as a class, the resistance barrier for protease inhibitors is going to improve with time. Right now with telaprevir and boceprevir, we frequently see resistance development after treatment if they fail. And as I hope you've gained an understanding of, there is a subtype dependence with 1As much more frequently having resistance than 1Bs. NS5A inhibitors I would put in a similar categorization. Right now, the resistance barrier is fairly low with NS5A inhibitors in advanced clinical trials, such as Decladosphere. although there are second and third generation compounds which also appear to have higher resistance barriers. From clinical studies such thus far, if patients do fail, resistance to NS5A inhibitors is very frequent. And again, there is a subtype dependence with 1As developing more frequent resistant variants than 1Bs. NS5B nucleoside and nucleotide inhibitors are particularly interesting from a resistance standpoint in that these drugs have the highest barriers to resistance of any of the direct-acting HCV antivirals that we've seen. In fact, I would characterize most as having an extremely high resistance barrier with kind of a 4-plus resistance barrier. In clinical trials, when patients fail, the majority fail with wild-type virus on sequencing. Resistant variants are either not detected or by the time they're sequenced, they're so unfit they've already reverted to wild-type or wild-type has outgrown them. There does not appear to be much of a subtype dependence with nucleotide inhibitors, especially when we're talking about 1A versus 1B HCV genotypes. Non-nucleoside HCV NS5B inhibitors are probably have the lowest resistance barrier. These are allosteric sites that are not necessarily highly conserved, and so resistance is seen frequently with failure. There is subtype dependence and genotype dependence, but it's not necessarily right along a 1A, 1B line. And then the last one included are cyclophilin inhibitors, which are not, they're acting on cyclophilin, which is a host molecule that's needed for HCV replication. And in line with that, they are more robust in terms of their resistance barrier, probably at least 3+. And clinical resistance during trials is fairly rare, and there's not a clear subtype dependence. The main issue with cyclophilin inhibitors right now is they're currently on clinical hold in most situations. Another important caveat, though, is we've seen in late-stage clinical trials that patients who do fail multi-class interferon-free regimens generally fail with multi-class resistance. So if you have a trial with a protease inhibitor plus an NS5A inhibitor, patients who fail will have resistance to both of those drug classes. The exception being studies that have included a nucleotide inhibitor in the combinations, as I alluded to before, resistance to nucleotide inhibitors with the signature being the S182T mutation are extremely rare. And then finally, again, the impact of resistance selection on salvage regimens is unknown. So to summarize now, HCV rapidly becomes resistant under non-curative therapy with most direct-acting antivirals. Although we don't think really from the virology, it has a mechanism to effectively archive resistant variants. The majority of patients who fail PI therapy with telaprevir or boceprevir will have resistant variants detectable at failure. Genotypic resistance testing does not have a well-defined role currently with telaprevir or boceprevir in combination with pegylated interferon and ribavirin. The best way to handle resistance is to prevent it from emerging. And in line with that, the best ways to prevent resistance are optimizing medication adherence. And with telaprevir and boceprevir, that can be a challenge. Dosing schedules are difficult with every 8 hours. And the drugs need to be taken properly with the appropriate food restrictions adhered to. And then drug-drug interactions should be avoided, especially ones that may be deleterious and lower the levels of telaprevir or boceprevir. An area for further study is clearly needed to determine the role of resistance in response to salvage therapy and interferon-free regimens.